Jason Kretzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, who's here on Mondays and Fridays, while I host on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. This is the second in a minimum of six programs I'm devoted to one of the most complex and controversial issues of our day, namely the events of 9/11 and how they can be most adequately understood. A firestorm of criticism has broken out within the 9/11 community over the suggestion that a kind of high-tech or directed energy weapon might have been involved. I'm afraid that a lot of those who are offering this criticism have a meager understanding of the nature of science. If we're devoted to discovering the truth about 9/11, we have to give consideration the full range of alternative possible explanations. In particular, if the simpler explanations are inadequate to explain all of the available evidence, we may be compelled to adopt a more complex explanation. There's a widespread misunderstanding about what is known in philosophy as Occam's razor, which suggests that you should prefer the simplest explanation. However, that is only true if it is also adequate to explain all of the relevant evidence. So today, we're going to have an extended exploration of the evidence that has to be explained. And I want to begin by talking about general principles of scientific reasoning and why it may be extremely important, if not indispensable, to the discovery of truth about 9/11, for us to consider a far broader range of possible alternative explanations than has heretofore been given serious consideration within the research community. When we talk about science, we're, of course, concerned with multiple principles, but most importantly, science does not deal in general with certitudes, with certainties, but rather with probabilities and likelihoods. The way in which probabilities and likelihoods are related is indispensable because when you consider different hypotheses in relation to the evidence, in general, you're entertaining those hypotheses as possible causes of that evidence as an effect. So when you have an hypothesis that confers a higher probability on that effect, then that hypothesis is preferable to others that confer a lower probability on that effect. And when you measure degrees of evidential support this way, they yield what are known technically as likelihoods, where the likelihood of an hypothesis given the evidence is equal to the probability of the evidence if the hypothesis were true. Now, science involves four steps or stages and a rule of inference known as inference to the best explanation that is built upon likelihoods as measures. Let me offer a simple example familiar to all. Suppose a typical police investigation, they discover a body. Now, the body may or may not have any marks. Suppose, for example, there are some bruises around the neck, okay? But there's an absence of any knife marks or knife wounds, bullet holes, bullet wounds, no foaming at the mouth and so forth, so that it may be apparent that if you take the body as it stands, that the probability that this body was caused by having been shot is extremely low. The probability that this body was the deceased was killed by being stabbed is very low. The probability that the deceased may have been strangled, given that there's some marks on the neck, however, may be fairly high. Now, if that's the evidence of
just kind of had a little flashback there. Gatlin runs the 100 meters in a record 9.76 seconds. You know, that's right. That's who we are. Thank you. And in April, he tested
positive. Did we get a miss? Did we get a miss?
Substance, and he accepted an 8-year ban from tracking.
Was I knocked off? Oh, are we back on? Where did I leave off? Did you catch? I'll go ahead. The point I'm making is in science we have to deal with probabilities and likelihoods. The likelihood of an hypothesis given evidence is equal to the probability of that evidence if the hypothesis were true. To take a simple example familiar to us all, suppose we have a dead body. And the dead body is basically clean. There are no knife marks. There are no gun wounds and so forth. But it does have some bruises around the neck. Well, if you consider the body in relation to alternative hypotheses about what may have brought about the demise of the deceased, then the probability that this person was killed by a gunshot is very low. The probability that this person was killed by a knife wound is very low. The probability that this person died by strangulation is higher. So that clearly, since the effect of those marks around the neck is relatively high given strangulation, and the absence of gunshot wounds or knife marks is highly improbable, if, in fact, he had been shot or wounded, then it's quite clear that the evidence makes the hypothesis of strangulation the preferable hypothesis. Now, if that's all we know about the case, then at that point in time, our preferable hypothesis about, you know, the cause of death of the decedent is strangulation. The body, however, is sent to the medical examiner who makes a more thoroughgoing examination. Suppose, for example, that the medical examiner discovers that, in fact, the person appears to have been poisoned using a barbiturate suppository, for an illustration. That is certainly in a cause that would not have been evident initially from merely inspecting the body. In that case, based upon the addition of new evidence, we have to reassess the relative likelihoods. And now the probability the deceiver was killed by poisoning may assume a higher probability even that they were strangled. And indeed, a more exact determination of cause of death may make it very clear that the individual died not by strangulation, but by poisoning. Now, if we carry this forward to the scientific problem we encounter in relation to 9/11, then there's a question here about the specificity of the what's known technically as the explanandum. That's the phenomenon to be explained. What is it we're trying to explain? If you just want to talk about, you know, that the buildings came down, the twin towers, 1 and 2, the North and South Tower came down, then you might consider a full range of possible explanations, including the jet plane impact, fuel fire, collapse theory, the government's advanced, a conventional controlled demolition from the bottom-up hypothesis, using conventional explosives, a variation on which might be the use of thermite, an unconventional controlled demolition from the top down, which might or might not use thermite, and as we go forward, if we find that there's sufficient aspects of the situation that thermite alone, for example, cannot explain, we want to consider or may find it essential to consider alternatives that we might not like on political grounds or based upon our simple ignorance of the case or what we prefer not to consider, possibility of the use of mini nukes or directed energy or some high-tech weapon that might be have emerged out of space-based technology. The United States has been engaged in a very serious attempt to develop space-based weapons related to satellites and the like that are going to have to receive consideration if, in fact, the evidence is not adequately explainable without them. So all of these hypotheses can be testable provided that they have effects that differentiate them from their alternatives. An example that would not be testable, however, is not a high-tech weapon, but the idea that the buildings came down as a consequence of God's will. None of us have any way of determining what is God's will, and yet Jerry Falwell has offered the suggestion that the reason for 9/11 was because God was punishing us for too many abortions, too many gays, and the ACLU. That's a bizarre hypothesis, but it's also unscientific. Stand by, we'll be right back. This is Jim.
The fuel fire and a pancake collapse is actually inconsistent with the evidence and even with the laws of physics and engineering. So that's not going to cut it. We know that this does not appear to have been a conventional demolition from the bottom up. In fact, all the floors are motionless, unlike Building 7, where we see all the floors coming down together. In a classic demolition, this is clearly a non-standard, a non-classic controlled demolition. It involves the destruction, the demolition of the building from the top down. The top is just turning to sawdust in the memorable metaphor of my guest today. So the question becomes, what can possibly account for this? And the greater degree of specificity we have of the explanandum, of exactly what it is we want to explain, which is going to include, among other things, for example, the total mass of the building, these structured weighs some 500,000 tons. The interval of time during which they came down, according to the 9/11 Commission report, the South Tower came down in 10 seconds. According to NIST, they came down in 9 seconds and 11 seconds. And yet that's even faster than free fall, where, say, a piano, depending on its dimensions, a small, very heavy piano might come down as fast as 12 and a half seconds. A lighter piano with its lid open as long as 30 seconds. We know faster than free fall is an impossibility if only acting under the influence of gravity. So it looks as though this whole thesis of collapse is completely unsustainable, and that being able to account for the disappearance of these buildings in less time than free fall is going to require some ingenuity in figuring out exactly what happened here. Thermite, we all know, has been proposed as an explanation, even in combination with other explosives. And the question is going to become whether thermite can possibly account for the full range of evidence that we encounter here. If thermite and other explosives, conventional explosives, can account for the full range of phenomena, that may be the simplest and therefore the preferable explanation. But if it cannot, if the degree of destruction and devastation of the World Trade Center is so massive, so enormous, so immense, so thorough, that it cannot be accounted for on that basis, then consideration may have to be given to more complex hypotheses, such as, say, mini nukes, or such as directed energy, or such as related to HAARP. And the HAARP project is extraordinarily interesting. The acronym stands for High Frequency Active Oral Research Program, or HARP. A lot of Americans are completely unaware of the extent of American research into space weapons and the like, which is why if you go to st911.org right now, if you go to the Scholars for 9/11 Truth homepage, you'll scroll down to events for 29 November, that's today, where I'm interviewing Judy Wood, who is a mechanical engineer, a civil engineer, a material science expert, who in my opinion may be the single most qualified person to ever study the physical properties of the events of 9/11, and you'll see a lot of links to her web pages. I'm going to invite Judy to take us on a tour of the evidence, so much of which is visual, and to explain the degree of devastation here and why it looks as though some kind of high-tech weapon that the public is not generally familiar with may well have been involved here. You'll also note it just below her links. There are two articles. One is Why Did the World Trade Center Buildings Disintegrate, co-authored by Morgan Reynolds and Judy Woods, which is an assessment of the adequacy of thermite as a scientific explanation. This is not a hit piece on the proponent of that view. It's a dissection or evaluation and appraisal of the theory he has advanced. So let there be no misunderstanding. This is not an ad hominem. This is a scientific appraisal. And then could HAARP have been used at the WTC, which I had put up today? I want to talk a bit about this. The Earth's atmosphere has three levels, the troposphere, which is up to about 3 miles, the stratosphere from 3 to 6, and then the ionosphere, which is above 6 miles. I'm just going to mention some highlights from some major projects. Project Angus back in 1958 involved the U.S. Navy exploding 3 fission-type nuclear bombs well above the South Atlantic Ocean in the part of the lower Van Allen belt closest to the Earth's surface. 2 hydrogen bombs were also detonated over Johnson Island in the Pacific. The military called this the biggest scientific experiment ever undertaken. It was designed by the U.S. Department of Defense and the Atomic Energy Commission. The purpose was to assess the impact of high-altitude nuclear explosions on radio transmission and radar operations because of the electromagnetic pulse generated and to increase understanding of the geomagnetic field and the behavior of charged particles. That was in 58. In 68, solar-powered satellite project. The U.S. military proposed solar-powered satellites in geostationary orbit some 8 miles above the Earth, which would intercept solar radiation using solar cells on satellites and transmit it via microwave beams to receive antennas called rectannas on Earth. The U.S. Congress mandated the Department of Energy and NASA to prepare an environmental impact assessment on this project to be completed by June 1980 and costing $25 million. The project was designed to construct 60 solar-powered satellites over a 30-year period at a cost between $500 and $800,000 million in $1968. 1977, leaping forward in 10-year increments, SPS military implications. Early review of the solar-powered satellite project began in around 1978. The SPS would be able to transmit power to remote military operations anywhere needed on Earth. The manned platform of the SPS would provide surveillance and early warning capability and ELF surveillance to submarines. That's extremely low-frequency connections with submarines. It would also provide the capability of jamming enemy communications. The potential for jamming and creating communications is significant. The SPS was also capable of causing physical changes in the ionosphere. Most importantly, then, the High-Frequency Active Oral Research Program, HARP. The HARP program is jointly managed by the Air Force and the Navy, based in Alaska, designed to understand, stimulate, and control ionospheric processes that might alter the performance of communication and surveillance system. The HARP system intends to beam 3.6 gigawatts of effective radiated power of high-frequency radio energy into the ionosphere in order to generate extremely low-frequency waves for communicating with submarines, conduct geophysical probes to identify and characterize natural ionospheric processes, generate ionospheric lenses to focus large amounts of high-frequency energy, thus providing a means of triggering ionospheric processes that potentially could be exploited by the Department of Defense. Now, the author of this article concludes with some concerns. It would be rash to assume that HARP is an isolated experiment which would not be expanded. It is related to 50 years of intense and increasingly destructive programs to understand and control the upper atmosphere. It would be rash not to associate HARP with a space laboratory construction which is separately being planned by the United States. HARP is an integral part of a long history of space research. The military implications are alarming. The ability of HARP space lab rocket combination to deliver very large amounts of energy comparable to a nuclear bomb anywhere on Earth via laser and particle beams are frightening. Stand by, we'll be right back. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, where Kevin Barrett will be with you on Mondays and Fridays. I'm in the midst of doing six programs in a row devoted to 9/11, and I'm delighted to welcome onto the show today my special guest, Judy Wood, who is a mechanical engineer, a civil engineer, and a material science expert. Judy, welcome to the show.
Hello, Jim. Thanks. I'm speakerphone. Is this working okay?
I think it might be better if you use your regular phone because we're getting an echo. If you can do that and still manage whatever.
Okay.
You,
is this working?
Oh, yeah. That's super.
Great, great. Thanks.
Just for the sake of our audience, Judy, I must say, I of course, did an interview with you on Republic Broadcasting Network, my last show on that network before I came here to Genesis, on the 11th, in which we discussed your research, and I was expressing great enthusiasm, and it's really for two or three reasons. One is because you have done such a marvelous job of exposing the full dimensions of the problem we have to explain, namely the totality of devastation and destruction to the World Trade Center. Second, that you have elaborated the significance of the bathtub as evidence in relation to what kind of causal mechanism may have been involved in destroying the towers. And third, of course, that you have been broadening the range of discussion to encompass hypotheses that go beyond those that have been generally considered within the research community. And I want to commend you and reiterate my enthusiasm for what you have been doing in all of these ways. And I know that so much of the evidence that you have been dealing with is visual, so I want to invite you to take us through your website. Tell us where to go, where I've invited everyone to go to st911.org. And scroll down to 29 November. So if you just tell us what pages to open, I want to turn this over to you so you can explain what your research is turning up.
Thank you. Let me start by telling folks to go to, no W's in it, just janedoe0911.tripod.com/StarWarsBeam1.html. And Star Wars Beam, S is capitalized, W is capitalized, and B is capitalized. You might find it easier to go to st911.org, go down to the 29th of November, and click on the links. There's a lot of links there, and we're going to start with page 1, which is Star Wars Beam 1. Meanwhile, let me tell you how I came to this. We were lied to. We were told this amazingly weird story about planes, you know, hitting the World Trade Center, the World Trade Center being on fire and pancaking down and so forth. And as you remember earlier, I did this billiard ball example where if you just go through this mental example of how the ball, you know, triggering billiard balls, releasing at various intervals, there's no way it's going to take 9 seconds, 10 seconds, 11 seconds. That's physically impossible. So right there, we know that the story we were told cannot be true. And if somebody lies to me with several lies that I know for sure are false, I'm not going to believe a whole lot more that they're saying. So what can we believe? We're being told a bunch of different information. What are you going to believe? What are you not going to believe? And I decided to start back at the beginning and look at the data and see what the data tells us. So you're right. My background is in experimental mechanics and, in particular, optical methods. But using optical methods to measure deformations of materials, stress, strain, and motion in materials and of objects. So I'm trained to look at what's going on physically. Well, what evidence do we have? I think, first of all, we need to establish what happened, because what we were told happened could not have happened. So we need to establish what happened, and then how it happened, why it happened, and who done it. But don't go jump into the other steps until you figure out what happened. So I began with no hypothesis, no theory. What evidence do I believe? What evidence do I kind of believe? What evidence do I not really believe? And there's a variety of stories we've been told. You know, the pancake story, the fires causing the buildings to pancake down, or progressive collapse, whatever words you want to use. Fires that burn for 99 days, molten metal, pools, rivers of molten metal, the building collapsed. Forget all that. Let's just start over. Wipe the slate clean and say, what is the data? So let's look at what kinds of data we do have. And I've got this at the top of page 1 of the Beam, Star Wars Beam article. And the paper began with a different name, but I came to this name, Star Wars Beam Weapon, as sort of what I concluded it came from, the Star Wars program. But I'm not sure. You know, but it seems like it could have. But in any case, whatever you want to call it, you can call it whatever name you like. But let's see what kind of evidence we have. Visual evidence. Are the towers still there? Well, if you've physically been there, been at ground zero, walked around there, you're kind of convinced they're not there. Somebody still may be playing tricks with your mind, but it's pretty good evidence. Eyewitness testimony. Right after the event, if it was recorded right after the event, and, you know, or shortly after that, there's eyewitness testimony, thanks to David Ray Griffin for getting it released, of emergency workers, firemen, policemen, who gave sort of depositions of what they had experienced. And then there's physical evidence in the form of actual physical items that have been preserved. Have they been tampered with? How have they been maintained, and do we have a chain of custody? If we took this to court, has it been locked up in the evidence room? How do we know it hasn't been tampered with? Then we have photographs. Ah, we have a huge, almost endless volume of photographs. Some may be tampered with, some may not be. But if they start backing each other, then you kind of can start maybe believing them. We have video footage, and then we have expert witness testimony. What is physically possible, and the quality of the analysis. So let's start out with the first picture. We have these huge towers. They're towering over any other skyscraper in New York City. They're just, like, overwhelming any skyscraper. 110 stories tall. And as Jim pointed out, 500,000 tons each went slamming down. Well, if that's what happened, what would we see? Well, it turns out that the towers were built on bedrock, which is located below the water table. So they had to isolate the outside water table from the base of the towers. And in that base is where you have PATH trains that go under the Hudson River over to New Jersey. And also you have a connector that goes over to the subway trains. So if you had some damage, you would have a disaster. If you damaged that bathtub wall, you'd have water leaking in from the walls, or if you jarred it, the PATH train tunnels might get a fissure in them and you'd get Hudson River water in there. And that would be a big problem. So let's look at the bathtub. And figure one, and two, we're still working on this paper, so the figures haven't been renumbered. But what they're, right now they each have an individual label. Figure one is the bathtub. Figure two is the PATH station platform after 9/11. The rescue workers went down there to see if anyone needed to be rescued. There you have a PATH train. Fully intact. You have water on the floor. And well, with all those hoses, fire hoses running, the water had to go somewhere.
Okay, well now, thank you for getting us started, Judy. I'm very glad to have my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer with the Dynamic Duo. We will be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo today. We're talking about 9/11 with my special guest, Judy Wood. Before I return to Judy, I'd like to just mention that in an address given to the November 11th Washington, D.C. 9/11 Truth Conference, Colonel Bob Bowman warned that 9/11 activists should not put all their eggs in one basket of research. Quote, "We have set ourselves up for criticism. We set ourselves up to be divided when we concentrate on things we can't prove. And even those things we think we can prove, somebody is going to pull the plug, going to come up with another explanation. You know, Professor Jones found thermite. Well, people can say, hey, that's used in cutting torches. That was done by the people who are cutting the building so they can load it on trucks and drive away. It doesn't matter what you got. You wind up arguing details and you lose the big picture." Bob Bowman, as some of you may know, has a Ph.D. in nuclear engineering and was the director of the Star Wars research program in both Democratic and Republican administration. So I think that we can take it from Bob Bowman that we need to keep a broad perspective here and consider a wide range of alternative hypotheses, which is where Judy's work comes in. Judy.
Thanks. Again, we're just looking at a tour of the data, just taking in what could have done this and start, you know, thinking. And Morgan Reynolds, who is a co-author in this work, has been great in asking me questions, and I ask him questions, and between the two of us, we've started pursuing more and more questions. And I went out on a picture hunt then, trolling the Internet to find what pictures I trusted and believed in, not having any preconceived ideas about what was supposed to happen. Remember, you start out with determining what happened first before how it happened. If you say you only have a slingshot and a BB gun, so it had to be one of those two things that brought down the towers, wait a minute, don't you know about anything else? What don't we know about? Instead of going that route, just say, what happened? How can we explain it? And pretty soon, it might start telling us the answer.
I think figure 9 is a fascinating one, Judy. You might tell us about that.
Figure 9 is a picture of the bathtub. That's the perimeter wall around Ground Zero, and they're partway through cleaning it out, and you can see that the parking structure is still intact in the north end. The north end is to the left. And
figure 17, which is a diagram, gives us a nice illustration of the massive damage that would potentially have been done if the Hudson River water had flowed in within the bathtub and swamped those PATH train cars and the subways throughout New York. It would have cost hundreds of billions of dollars.
Picture 17 was from a newspaper, and I, you know, remember you weigh everything out, take it kind of with a grain of salt or more or less. And but what's interesting about figure 17, that's what you're talking about, figure 17?
Yes.
Notice the most damaged area is to the right, away from the Hudson direction. Isn't that interesting? It's not towards the direction of the Hudson River.
The reddish area, yes.
What?
The reddish area, the area that's
right,
indicates
red.
The more severely damaged.
And in figure 14, you see some folks going into the PATH train tunnels that go under the Hudson. They don't look damaged. They don't look collapsed in. So going down below, there are some things that were rescued and saved in, I think it's Hangar 77 or Hangar 17 at JFK International Airport. It's sort of a museum of what was in the World Trade Center before the event. Well, here we have Roadrunner, Foghorn Leghorn, and Bugs Bunny. They were in, their life-size characters, or even greater than life-size characters, they were in the Warner Brothers store in a mall that was in the first sub-basement, right adjacent to the South Tower, which is WTC-2. So if they had this 500,000-ton building fall on them, they came out without a scratch, true to their character.
Really astonishing. I've been fascinated by your studies of the King Dome, too, if we move down to 21, 22, and so forth.
Right.
Could you explain why that's so significant?
Right. So we have this 500,000-ton crash onto the bedrock. Well, what was recorded? It turns out that the Palisades recording location had measured the equivalent earthquake energy of a 2.1 and a 2.3 earthquake for Tower 2's collapse, quote, collapse, and Tower 1's collapse. Why weren't they the same? And they show the chart of Tower 1, which is a 2.3, and they also give one for January 17th, 2001 earthquake. They don't look the same. They have a different character. Who knows why? Then, okay, so let's look at other known seismic events. If we have a building collapse, what should we expect? Well, we have the King Dome. The King Dome was one-fourth of the mass, but it was a whole lot lower to the ground. And the potential energy difference between the two is a factor of 30. So if one of the towers crashed to the ground, it should hit the ground 30 times harder than the King Dome did, if they're both on bedrock. Now, the King Dome was on the softer material that kind of muffles the recording instrument, but we'll pretend they were both the same, because if there's an error, the error would show that the King Dome would have recorded a larger signal. So what I did is look at the comparison. Now we go to page 2. Look at the comparison of the potential energy of the two. And looking at that comparison, it appears that the we should have seen at least a 3.8 earthquake with a 30 times greater mass, or, you know, a potential energy hitting it from much higher above. So what's the difference? Now, okay, how could we make one of the towers hit the ground and make the same earthquake energy impact as the King Dome? How about if we decapitate the top half of the building? If the lower half falls, what kind of earthquake would it make? Well, how about if we take out more than the top half? How about if we take out 80% of the top of one of the towers and drop that to the ground? Ah, we're getting close. Turns out 16 floors, the bottom 16 floors of the South Tower, would explain its 2.1 earthquake.
Now, Judy, are you including the sub-basement levels there? Or
no, I'm talking about just what's above ground.
Uh-huh.
Only above ground. So we're going to have a little bit of more material below there. And remember, it's anchored into bedrock. That's a huge difference.
You're saying if it were to be the case that the towers would have the same earthquake effects or significance as the King Dome, then they could only have had about 20% of their total mass in order to achieve that comparable effect.
Right. The South Tower made an equivalent 2.1 earthquake, and if you just take the bottom 16 floors and drop them, they would make that kind of earthquake. So what happened to the rest of the building? Did it drop even? From that evidence, it didn't seem to drop. Okay, that's just one data point. But if you look at how much dynamite went into blowing up the King Dome and its mass, and you multiply it by 4, you can assume that much dynamite would be needed to blow up the towers. But they're also being dropped from higher up. And again, you come up with a 3.5 magnitude earthquake, not a 2.1. So that doesn't seem to add up. It really appears that the entire towers did not drop.
And, of course, a 3.5 is overwhelmingly greater as an earthquake given the nature of the Richter scale.
It's a logarithmic scale. So between 2 and 3 is a factor of 10 in energy.
10 times more powerful an earthquake.
Right. And then if we look at the pile of rubble after the kingdom comes down, it's 30 feet high. And the people will tiny characters next to it. There was a whole lot of material left. Well, how much material is left after the towers came down? Remember all the search images we saw that day? The search people were walking horizontally.
And, of course, the kingdom, you mentioned in one of your statistics that what is left there when the kingdom comes down is about 12.5% of the total mass, which
right.
we would then expect would be the case with the World Trade Center, but it's vastly less than that.
Much less.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. We're discussing the physics of the destruction of the World Trade Center. Stand by. Jim Fetzer, this is the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Judy Wood. We're discussing the physics and potential explanation of the devastation at the World Trade Center. Judy, some in the audience may find it fascinating to look at the total degree of devastation that you begin discussing on page 3. And then coming backward to the importance of some of your calculations vis-a-vis the kingdom, but I leave this in your hands.
So the calculations are on the web, and we haven't really finished, again, the article. But, yes, let's pick up on page 3. And the first picture, photograph, is figure 32, where the street is filled with dust. Not quite ankle deep, but it does fill in the curbs, and you can see tire tracks in it. What could have made all of this dust? And notice the sun is blocked out. You can't really see down the end of the street. You can see a little bit of sunlight coming through at the next intersection. Perhaps that's the top half of the buildings. And the next picture down is an aerial view of Ground Zero. And where's the building? You see some walls. I call those wheat checks. They look like wheat checks. The outer columns and bundles. But there's a few, like, little barely skinny walls standing up all by themselves, unsupported. There's nothing else there. The next picture down, you see the building turning into dust. The dust is going up. A lot of it's going up. Why would it be going up if the building was collapsing down? In normal, regular, controlled demolition, you can watch the top of the building move downward. Here, the top of the building is obliterated, and you see an awful lot of material going up. That was another big difference with the kingdom. The kingdom, the dust didn't really rise above the highest point of the building. But here, there's a smoke that was pouring out of the buildings ahead of time. Maybe that was to hide the fact that, you know, suddenly the cloud got bigger. Suddenly, a whole lot of dust, smoke, whatever you want to call it, started going upward. Pretty much of a puzzle. But in figure 34, you'll notice a little bit less standing on the right. And then I have a close-up shot of that where, wow, it looks like the building is actually turned to dust as it stands right before your eyes.
36 sequence, for example.
Right. There's a sequence there. The video link, for some reason, isn't working. I've noticed it's been posted all over the Internet on lots of blogs. And I wonder if my host turned off that link. I'll put up a different link.
Don't worry, because you're, what you have there, that sequence 36 and 37, certainly conveys exactly what
you
see.
Oh, yes. And there's also a CNN video of it where Aaron Brown, it almost seems like he knows what's going on. He feels embarrassed. He says, oh, that was just smoke. It was hiding behind smoke.
Look at 40A and 40B, Judy. Those are just astounding because there's obviously no possible way the government's official account could explain all this. And I think the question in many of our audience's mind is this the kind of devastation that could possibly have been brought about by some kind of thermite, even in a sophisticated nanotechnology-enhanced version?
Well, 40A really struck me. That's one of my favorite pictures. I call it the snowball picture. It looks like a big snowball. And the building in the little bit closer to us, the black building, is 40 stories tall. And behind that is Tower 2 going poof. Tower 2 is supposed to be 110 stories. So we're the top 70 or 75 stories. They're not there. They haven't fallen down. You don't see them below that snowball.
They've been pulverized.
They're just gone.
Disintegrated.
Yeah, wafting up to heaven. They're just not there. You see some of the aluminum cladding from the outer part of the building flying off, but nothing else. And the 40B it looks like the building has gone through a blender or a liquidizer.
Some kind of pulverizer. Then I know you have a fascination with 314A, the next...
Oh, yes, yes. That actually came from the NIST report. Here you have this chunk of wheat checks flying overhead, flying over WTC-3. How many people talk about WTC-3? It kind of gets ignored. But if you follow along the roof line, when you get to the right-hand corner, you notice it's kind of warped looking. It looks like kind of a brown seahorse with his back against the wall. It's warped. The building's coming apart as we're looking at it. And if you notice that chunk of wheat checks on the right, it's turning to dust as we look at it. It's kind of got this funny wrinkled look, and it's streaming dust as it falls. Now, is that a contrail?
No.
What is causing it? And then the wheat checks overhead are turning brown, and that looks like brown mush or whatever coming out the back. It's
about Bill Biggert's photographs, the next couple of photographs.
Right. And
are haunting.
And when the first time I saw that last photograph, and that was the last photograph he ever took in his life, he died right after that, I felt a really strong connection to it. There was something important in there, and I didn't get it for the first couple of years. Now I do. That's one of the few pictures we have of Building 3. Half of it was destroyed while Tower 2 was destroyed, and the other half was destroyed when Tower 1 was destroyed. This is the picture in between the two. In between Tower 2 going poof and Tower 1 going poof. Notice the straight vertical cuts into them. And on 315B, very straight vertical cuts.
I've described that 315B as though a gigantic Zorro took his sword and took a couple of whacks.
Yeah, a big bite taken out of the middle of the building. That's a 22-story building. Where is the material that came out of the middle? It's not in front. And those wheat chicks were flying overhead. Where did they land?
55B and 313 are just stunning indications of how complete and total was the devastation.
There's nothing left. And if you go to 55B right below there, that was taken 2 days later, you can see there's nothing left of Building 3.
Now, of course, some would say, well, of course, part of it is underground, right, because of the sub-basement. Whatever.
Oh, we'll get to that in the next segment. We're going to go underground and look to see what's there.
Okay. And in 313, of course, you have this total devastation.
Right. You see this on the right, there's nothing really left of the 22-story building. And on the left, you see this kind of fog hovering over Building 2's carcass. And you see these outer walls sitting here. What is that fog? Where's it coming from? If something was on fire, you'd see the source of it, where it was coming from. You have this fog that's just kind of hanging over. Is that... perhaps metal that's kind of, or molecules from the metal that are just kind of wafting up.
Something that's fascinated me about 41, 42, and 43 is how you have this immense source of energy, and yet it doesn't destroy paper.
Right.
There's
41, you're standing on Church Street looking south. To the right is buildings 4 and 5, but you just have paper in the street. You have some fire, but the paper isn't on fire.
And the paper have not been on fire just because it has so little mass? I just don't know what to make of it.
We're just taking in the data here. And when you see aluminum cladding, we don't see any steel or anything else. We just have paper and aluminum cladding.
Okay.
And further on down, we just see lots of dust, huge dust on the oranges. You know, it's like it snowed dust.
And 44 and 45 are spectacular, particularly 45.
Right. It's a dust fountain. It looks like a bubbler. If you're from the upper Midwest, you know, the drinking fountain looks like a bubbler.
Or some kind of volcanic explosion.
That's not a collapse look to me. And 46, this pitiful look on this guy's face, is he's still so overwhelmed. He's going to clean up the building with a shovel.
Fascinating.
And on the right, those guys are standing at essentially lobby level. There's no building there. Where'd it go?
And look at 48. My God, the totality of the devastation.
And that black building you see in the foreground, seven times the volume of that building is what was destroyed. Can you count for it in that picture you see?
Utterly fascinating, utterly fascinating. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett. And my special guest today is Judy Wood. Judy, I must say some of the most fascinating photographs in your collection are those on your next page, 54, 55A, and 56, which are photographs of Building 6, displaying a devastating kind of destruction that, that seem would seem to defy conventional explanation.
Well, no, we're not looking for the explanation yet. We're just observing. And you're right. We're on page 4. It starts out with an overhead shot, and then there's an oblique angle shot, probably from a helicopter, where you notice this big gaping hole in Building 6. But it looks empty. It looks like vertical cuts, as though somebody was taking a soil sample, where they take this cylindrical core sample down into the earth and pull it out, and there's nothing left.
And there's a less discernible but equally striking hole in Building 5.
And also look across the street, or into the street. You have about 20 floors, the lower 20 floors of the North Tower, laying in the middle of the West Side Highway. You don't see much in between there and the street. It's almost like that lower chunk of wall jumped out into the street, did kind of a pirouette, rotated around, and laid down the street.
Are you talking about 55A now?
Yes. That section almost made that twisty turn, and it just barely nicked the building across the street on the right, and which is it's just an interesting observation. They got that steel moved out fairly fast, but that's one of the largest sections of steel that we saw. Imagine a 110-story building, and that's all you see left.
You can see the cavities in 6 and 5 more easily in 56.
And you look in there, it's just an empty hole with vertical slices into it. So we go down to the next building, and that's that look across the street. This is taken 2 days after 9/11.
Bankers Trust.
Right, 55B and 55C. We're looking across West Side Highway, and we see those beams laid out there. The following picture is another oblique angle of the big empty hole in Building 6, which is bizarre. Then, we pass Bankers Trust, and we notice on the Bankers Trust, we have an aerial view of just the roof of a building. You see a few pieces of aluminum cladding, but that's it. You don't see those steel wheat checks.
And you
they only start flying
holes.
Out in the lower 24s.
And you don't have any massive holes gouged out either.
Any what?
No massive holes are gouged out, as in
no, no. It's just, and remember this big black building in what's now called Figure 11? That was what we saw in the foreground in the snowball picture.
Yeah.
And we don't see any solid material.
You got a great map of the World Trade Center at 59A and 59B, a photograph that corresponds to
it. And 59B, look how tall those buildings are, and look at those little itty-bitty buildings way down the ground that look like they're one story tall. There's 8 and 9 stories tall. And then the next picture, figure 57,
just stunning.
You see nothing left. It's just gutted out. Except you see this little stub of a building in the lower center of the picture, which is kind of odd. And we keep on going down. There's another picture. It's called Figure Wall right now because it doesn't have a number yet. That one is the most stunning. Spooked, who runs Covert Operations Blogspot, shared this picture with me. It is just amazing. Look at the little stub of the north wall of Tower 1. This left on the right side of the picture.
The wheat checks above the dome.
Figure Wall is what it's called.
These are the wheat checks above the dome.
Yeah, right above the dome you see what's left of Tower 1, and then to the left of that you see the Building 6 with a big hole in it, and to the left of that you see the remnants of WTC 7, which is huge compared to Tower 1.
And of course 7, we all know, came down by a conventional demolition, so that's an interesting contrast.
Right, and this building in between is an 8-story building, and it towers over the remnants of Tower 1. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
Now, the wheat checks there, the outer wall, are at most 10 stories tall. 10 stories tall, so that means there's 100 stories left to be accounted for. As it's leaning to the left, where'd they go? They didn't fall on Building 6.
I think this is an excellent idea of what has to be explained. I think you've given us an excellent tour of the evidence that has to be explained. I mean, if you flip down a couple more to 63, I mean, the destruction is total and complete and massive, and it's the entire World Trade Center.
There's nothing left.
And it's not just Building 1 and 2, even if you throw in 7, which we know had a completely different cause of demolition or collapse.
Figure 63Z was taken inside of that hole of Building 6, and you can see it's empty down to the ground.
So something has just demolished the inside of the building. Like, it just ate it out. There's nothing left.
Like
having an organ removed in surgery. Now you have it, now you don't.
It just disappeared. If we go down to figure 60, now that is the upper left corner of the picture is the footprint of Tower 2. And the lower part of that, to the right, is the remnants of Building 4. The main part of Building 4 is to the left of that, but there's nothing there. But what is really interesting is way on the left side of the picture, near the top, you see a round black hole in the street. That's always fascinating to me, the hole in the street. And it seems to line up with the wheat checks that are leaning out over it. I'm talking about the upper left
corner.
The dark
area near the red crane?
Yeah, it's...
Just below the red crane.
Well, it's figure 60, yeah, with the red frame, near the upper left corner. And it's just outside of the footprint of Tower 2.
Oh, above the red crane, because there's also like...
Oh, yeah, above the red crane. I think I meant red frame of the picture. Yeah, above the red crane, you see a round circular hole in the street.
Right, adjacent to the wheat checks.
Yep, and if you notice the wheat checks that are leaning over that hole, they have a cutout that lines up with it.
You notice you also have an oval-like gouge just below the red crane.
Right, there's some trash laying loosely on top, but you can see how dark it is there. That it looks like it might be a void under there. So now we go down to the next picture. Let's go down in those holes. If you notice in the next picture, figure 302, right behind the fellow by the stepladder, you see the wheat checks. That's the edge of building 2, of tower 2. He just is about to climb down to or just climbing out of the hole in the ground. It's within a week of 9/11. So in the picture on the right, it shows a diagram, and he's in hole 2, we call it. Hole 1 is that round one in the middle of the street.
About 303.
And 303, they're climbing down the ladder, down into the middle of the basement of Tower 2. And it looks like that fellow with a big 2 on his back with a flashlight, he looks like he's standing in a puddle, or at least it's a sloppy, wet surface. And perhaps that's bedrock that he's on, not sure, but it's a very horizontal surface. They're not on their hands and knees.
That's on figure 300, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was thinking it was a different number. And notice how empty that hole is. How did it get that empty? Sure, they weren't excavating. They're still in the recovery mode. They're looking for survivors.
They're not digging out
the basement.
This is Jim Fetzer on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Judy Wood. We're discussing the demolition of the World Trade Center. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Judy Wood. We're discussing the destruction of the World Trade Center. Judy, you've done such a wonderful job of putting together a photographic record of the destruction. I'd like to invite you to address the principal theories that might be available to explain the phenomena that you've so vividly described. I've been very impressed by the way in which you summarize the descriptive findings in terms of your principal data. Perhaps you could discuss this and then highlight it with a couple of specific issues of great interest.
Well, I think it still comes back to, and I think it's important to look back at page 4, the end of page 4, or near the bottom, you have the rescue workers going down into the mall, which was in the first sub-basement, right underneath where supposedly Tower 2 was to have fallen. So the first floor below, basement below the ground, and these guys are walking around, standing erect. You can see Innovations Incorporated or whatever, the sign for a store on the side. They're walking around the mall, and that apparently is where Roadrunner got rescued from. So whatever happened did not seem to go below ground, which was bizarre. And then looking on page 5, where I had the toasted cars, that's what really, where it all started to click with me, is the first picture is of this police car with a wilted door, missing door handles, the front tire is missing. Well, no, not all of the tire. The rubber's missing. He still has the steel belts from his tire there. And if you look out, you can see over the car and see the East River. He's on the FDR Drive, this vehicle is. So what is this police car, an FDR drive, doing that looks like a wilted vehicle? And you look below that, there's plenty of other toasted vehicles with all sorts of the weirdest patterns. and maybe the outside's burnt, but the inside isn't, or the inside's burnt and the outside isn't.
Excellent.
It's a very big puzzle.
And these were nowhere near the World Trade Center, per se.
Right. And with my background in optics, I started thinking, okay, you have, like, canyons. You know, the buildings make canyons in New York City.
Yeah.
Did you have reflections of some kind of
energy
beam? You know, like, if it was a visual light, you could reflect light off of the various buildings in it, or even sound. You know how canyons echo.
And when you say beam, of course, you mean stream of energy, right?
Right. Like, whether it's sound, like you go to the Grand Canyon, you yell something, you hear it echo.
Yes.
Down the canyon. It bounces off the walls.
Energy,
the same thing
waves.
In New York City. If you have, maybe it isn't the wavelength of sound, maybe it's the wavelength of, light, maybe it's, it's some kind of energy that could, it's conceivable that it could reflect down and end up on FDR Drive. Because there's a whole lot of cars, like all the cars that were on FDR Drive look like they got toasted. But this weird pattern, and you see cars that are with their engine blocks burning, but the beautiful wax job on the back end looks just fine. That's where the gas tank is in the back end, and it didn't blow up. So we start putting it all together. Oh, energy beam, maybe. It starts coming together. And why do you have this, look on bottom page 5, you have a perfectly healthy, brand-new-looking fire truck, except all the windows have been blown out of it, and its rearview mirrors have been blown off. It just seems bizarre. So was it, that lady singing at the opera that did it?
Rip.
So if we go to page 6, we haven't finished this yet, but these are mainly placeholders, but we start looking at things. Like at the top we have the Bankers Trust building, which was right across the street from Tower 2. And you see this weird gouge down the front, and it looks like a cylindrical cutout. There's a WeCheck sitting in it, but that WeCheck has square ends. No way could it have made that big gouge. And then there's a picture from the FEMA report, from the FEMA report, that shows a shriveled up beam, kind of like you pulled a hair out of your head, scraped your fingernail down it so it would coil up.
Right in the middle, the yellowish beam with a contracted, atrophied end.
It looks like, a hair from your head that you scraped your fingernail along so it would coil up. It just is shriveled up looking on the end.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a mechanical failure.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some interesting things I noticed from Paul Thompson's timeline about when all the planes were ordered to land, including military flights, except for a few top-secret missions. And the military flights were allowed to return to flight within two minutes of when Tower 1 went poof. Pretty bizarre.
And, of course, Tower 1 went down second, so you're talking about the completion of the demolition of the of the Twin Towers, and with it the World Trade Center taking place at what appears to be the same time.
And what it looked to me like, if the first tower was Tower 2 that went down, that top was rotated over deliberately, it looks like. Because as I have this little diagram under it, once it starts to turn, all the load is on the lower corner, and the upper corner has less load on it, so why is it going to fail? So once it starts to tilt like that, why is the rest going to fail? Why is the back end of that tilt exploding? So that's kind of bizarre. But the fact that that whole chunk tipped over and supposedly was going to crash down on Building 4, but then nothing's left by the time it hits the ground.
Steve and I had a conversation about it once where he said how we'd looked at it very carefully and it starts to tilt and pivot and all of a sudden it's no longer there.
Right. It kind of gets disintegrated. And then if we start looking at the remnants left on the ground.
76, 77, 78.
78. In 78, it's a view from the east side looking west and you can see the wall, 78A, you can see the wall of the west wall of Tower 2. And on the right, you see the north wing of Tower 4, or Building 4, but nothing else left.
And look at the 79 series, my goodness, and the 80 series.
Yeah, is this, but the fact that in 78A, that north wing looks surgically removed in a vertical cut, that's not a natural-looking process.
Right.
And you get, plenty of devastation all the way down. Now, starting to sum things up. Yes, people talked about explosions. Well, it would look kind of bad. It would be kind of tacky if the building turned into a mushroom cloud, first, into a clear blue sky.
Yes.
But if you had all the smoke already and then the smoke just got bigger, and also you need to have the top look like it's dropping. So, okay, you could use, I'm just hypothesizing here, you could use some dynamite sticks in there and maybe to get the top to start moving down, and then you kick in the rest of your high-tech gizmos, maybe. And people are going to accept dynamite, especially if you have a couple of puffs going out here and there.
Or it could be something more powerful than dynamite, like this RDX stuff and all that.
Well, if we notice those round holes in Building 6, it was full of bullet holes. And speaking of bullet holes, there are some interesting telltales in those clouds that represent very, very high energy expansion. And from what I'm seeing in those, and I can go into more detail later, it's much more powerful than a nuclear.
Well, we won't have an opportunity today to go much further. I would invite you to go down to your conclusions, which provide a wonderful summary of the evidence,
okay,
and talk about the theories that might possibly explain them, and to just talk about why the theories, respectively, don't seem to be adequate to account for the evidence.
If you said something about the data that we've just covered, we've been looking at various aspects of the data.
Right.
And, you know, it seems like there's got to be some kind of high-tech weapon out there that we haven't really been that familiar with. And I looked at various kinds, and there's plenty of evidence out there for things that have been developed over the years.
So just to move down to your box about what theories are available, here you're talking about natural causes like earthquakes and hurricanes, arson, the official theory of airplane impact, fires and weakened steel collapsing, conventional demolition with explosives like RDX, dynamite, and so forth, demolition versus thermite or its variants.
All those five get thrown by the wayside because of the potential energy issue with the impact to the ground. We didn't see the seismic effect. We didn't see the damage to the bathtub.
Judy, we'll be right back with you, my special guest on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer. Stand by. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today we're discussing the destruction of the World Trade Center with my special guest, Judy Wood. Judy, let me see if I can summarize some of your views, and you correct me if I have anything wrong. We're looking at the summary of conclusions, the principal data, 18 different points that characterize the explanandum, what has to be explained. You're looking at alternative theories, including the first five, natural causes, arson, airplane impacts, the official story, conventional demolition, and demolition using thermite or thermate. And I take it your inference is that the probability of those 18 effects, more or less, in relation to those causes are all quite low in relation to the two other possibilities you mentioned here, fission or fusion or beam weapons, which I would class, you know, more broadly as directed energy weapons. Is that,
right,
is that correct
far? We had two 500,000-ton buildings go away.
Two 500,000-ton buildings go away. If they'd actually collapsed onto the bathtub, almost certainly it would have fractured or fissioned in such a way to allow...
Oh, and they were, during the cleanup work after 9/11, they realized very quickly how much they were damaging the bathtub wall with their earth-moving equipment.
Just by earth-moving equipment, which, to the best of my knowledge, does not weigh 500,000 tons.
Correct. And they were driving the trucks over various places, and they realized that they were doing serious damage to the bathtub wall.
So you're suggesting that if the bathtub wall had cracked sufficiently to allow the Hudson River in, it would have flooded the PATH train tunnels, the subways, caused massive damage, hundreds of billions, it would have taken, you know, a decade to clean up. And
the underground of New York City would have been flooded.
So you're suggesting that this was done in such a way as to avoid that consequence.
Correct. And if you notice, the only buildings destroyed had a prefix of WTC.
It's almost a surgical operation, isn't it? When you look at the variety of buildings there, that the only ones that are totally demolished are those with WTC designations. That's quite stunning. Now, are you willing to entertain...
Even the PATH train tracks stayed completely intact. When they were moving around, you know, with earth-moving equipment, they covered them with wooden slats so they could drive over them without damaging them.
Now,
they didn't want to have to even go through the expense of replacing the train tracks.
Now, are you willing to entertain something that might call a multi-causal or multi-factorial analysis where you have, say, most of the buildings taken out by some sophisticated directed energy means, but then the rest of the buildings, say, might be brought down by something more conventional, maybe using thermite or thermate.
What do you mean the rest? The weak checks, you know, that unsupported, you know, skinny little wall standing?
Yes.
The top might have gotten started with something else.
Yeah.
Because it would look kind of funny if the building started disintegrating from the top down without looking like something failed.
There was something there to vaguely resemble what you would have expected to find.
Right.
Now,
it was a very good Hollywood movie prop.
My own conception is that the massive explosions in the sub-basements may have been with one type of weapon, and then the destruction of the top 80% of the buildings, the Twin Towers with another type of weapon, and then the last 20 floors or whatever brought down with something like thermite, which, of course, would account for why thermite was present.
In the paper, we talk about, when I talk about the potential energy, that with it, for the South Tower, 16 floors, or the North Tower, 20 floors, that much material would account for the boom that the bedrock felt. So if you look at just, let's say gut out all the concrete and marble floors and desks and chairs and everything else and just leave the steel structure, maybe, 30 floors worth. Whatever it was that got to it, what we're just looking at the data, it was selective on what material it was attacking.
Now, you mentioned in point 18 the possibility that a technology of this kind might exist, and of course I've been reviewing all of the elements or stages in the HAARP developmental project, which goes back to 1958 with Project Argus, to 68 with Solar Power Satellite Project, to 78...
And that's what you know about.
With
what you don't know about.
Military implications, yes. That's right, what we know about. And then we get to HAARP with 1993... And recall the summary of this, and we all have it available to us right there online, the conclusions that it would be rash not to associate HAARP with a space laboratory construction being separately planned by the U.S. HAARP is an integral part of a long history of space research and development of a deliberately military nature. The military implications of combining these projects is alarming. The ability of the HAARP space lab rocket combination to deliver very large amounts of energy comparable to a nuclear bomb anywhere on Earth via laser and particle beams is frightening, and we're talking about an amount of beam here. The HAARP system intends to beam 3.6 gigawatts of effective radiated power of high-frequency radio energy.
What I have seen in the visual evidence is something far more powerful than what I've seen with the, I've analyzed the nuclear test blast.
Yeah.
This is far more powerful.
Now, this leaves a wide range of possibility for how this energy source might have been delivered. You mentioned, for example, reflective mirrors, and with your background in study of optics, it could be a ground base reflected by means of mirrors, and you even cited reports from a 1991 study that showed that this was extremely precise.
Oh, it surpassed all their expectations and then some. And it's in my appendix pages 2 and 3, or our appendix pages from the website. There's articles there that show test studies, they show the design of it, they even show the price of it.
And I
when they're comparing the price list for ground-based versus space-based, and space-based is much
frankly,
cheaper.
When I did my research on the plane crash that killed Senator Paul Wellstone, I was driven to the conclusion, and I had several collaborators, one a Ph.D. in physics with a specialty in electromagnetism, we were driven to the conclusion that the plane was brought down using a high-tech weapon of a relatively modest variety in relation to this, that created a surge of energy that overwhelmed the electrical system and flipped the solenoids in the plane and turned their props to idle, bringing about an inevitable crash. I've had encounters with this before, and when challenged about the existence, I did a lot of research on, among other things, turned up that there is a professional society for directed energy weapons that's been meeting for at least 10 years. At the time I was checking them out, they were having their annual meeting in Hawaii. So I hardly think that this is we're dealing with imaginary products here or weapons. In fact, Raytheon has numerous patents on weapons of this kind in the high energy
Joseph Grumman,
weapon.
And there's on page 6 of our website. There's some test runs of shooting down missiles and rockets with this weapon. So it's in use, and it's
with
in use
weapons
in Iraq
of one
right
or another
now too.
Kind. And I'd like to reiterate, for the sake of our audience, Bob Bowman, remember, this man directed the Star Wars research project that, is so intimately involved in a lot of these issues. And the reason why Judy refers to it as a Star Wars weapon to suggest its origin. He advised us on November 11th at a December truth conference in Washington, D.C., that we shouldn't put all of our eggs in one basket of research. He said, quote, "We have set ourselves up for criticism. We set ourselves up to be divided when we concentrate on things we can't prove, and even those things we think we can prove, somebody's going to come up with another explanation." You know, Professor Jones found thermite. thermate. Well, people can say that's using cutting torches. That was done by the people who are cutting the buildings up so they can load it on tracks and drive away. It doesn't matter what you've got. You wind up arguing details and you lose the big picture. The big picture is, what hypotheses, what causes can possibly bring about the effects that Judy has so vividly portrayed here in photographs, diagrams, and other forms of recording?
Where did the material go?
We have to look for the hypotheses that can confer the highest probability on the evidence, which acquire the highest likelihood. Judy?
Yeah, where'd the material go? That's what it comes down to. You don't have enough material there.
And let me just say, if our dedication is to truth, if we're here to find out what happened, if we have a problem to solve, a problem of explanation of what happened at the World Trade Center, then we have to do it. We can't pull our punches. We can't exclude alternatives just because we may not like them and think they're going to be politically unpopular, that the press is going to have a field day. If this problem is going to be resolved of what happened at the World Trade Center, it may be that we are the only entity that will ever actually subject it to serious investigation. So I say, everyone who's seriously interested in what happened on 9/11, let us band together to discover the truth by free and unfettered inquiry. I'm so grateful you tuned in to listen to us. You can hear it again on our archive at Genesis. GenesisGCNLive.com has an archive. Check it out. Thank you for listening. This is Jim Fetzer, the Dynamic Duo.